Our next case is 20-14485, SRMOF 2009-1 Trust versus Sherry Lewis et al. For the appellant, Mr. Engel.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of rebuttal time today. We're here on yet another foreclosure case. In this case, it involves a conflict among Ohio's appellate courts about exactly what a lender must possess at the time it files suit in order to have standing to proceed in a foreclosure case. More specifically, the issue is whether it is possible for the holder of mere legal title to a security interest to have standing to enforce that security interest, even if it's not entitled to enforce the underlying debt. Ms. Lewis urges the court to order that in order to have standing to foreclose, the plaintiff must possess the entitlement to enforce the underlying debt.
Counsel, if you could address, your friends on the other side have said that we really shouldn't even be hearing this case because there was no prayer for personal judgment against Ms. Lewis because her liability had been discharged in bankruptcy. How would you respond?
The discharge of her liability in bankruptcy does just that, the discharge of her liability. It does not discharge the debt. If it discharged the debt, we wouldn't be here today. The debt is still owed. It's just that she is not personally liable for it.
Who owes it?
The personal liability is extinguished, but the debt itself exists, Your Honor. The real issue here is ultimately enforcement of the mortgage, which is the sole basis now.
Who owes the debt?
She does not personally owe it. And I understand what you're trying to get to, and this is one of the things about bankruptcy that at times a little difficult to get your head around. The debt is still the obligation of the real estate, if you want to think about it that way, perhaps similar to real estate taxes in which there is no personal liability to pay the taxes. But if you don't pay, bad things happen, like the county comes and takes your property. So I think we're in a similar situation.
So she discharged the debt. She has no liability to pay this mortgage. Correct? That's her current status.
Correct, but her property can be seized.
It can be seized, and because the bank says this property is enveloped in a debt, so to speak, and we need to get paid, and the way we can do that is to take this asset and dispose of it so that at some point we can get paid.
That's correct, but that does not disturb the essential nature of the claim, and I do not believe that it's really a relevant distinction in this case. As we know in a foreclosure case.
Is she still in the home?
Yes, she is. As we know in a foreclosure case, as with all secured lending transactions, you have two distinct contracts. And the first is in this case, a promissory note, which represents the debt. The second agreement is a security interest, in this case, a mortgage. Which secures payment of the debt.
So doesn't her personal liability, though, go to the note?
Her personal liability does go to the note, but the note still represents the debt. As this court said in 1895 in the Kernahan v. Mann's case, the debt is represented by the note. The mortgage is a mere incident to the debt. It is a lien to secure payment of the debt, but by itself it has no life. And by itself is not the fit subject of an assignment.
I'll just put my cards out there for you, counsel.
Please.
My concern is, did we improvidently allow this case? Is this actually in conflict with the other districts where there wasn't a discharge in bankruptcy? And is this a case that we should not have taken in?
I think this is a case that the court absolutely should take, because I do not believe even a little bit that the fact that there was a bankruptcy discharge affects the underlying analysis at all. I believe the underlying analysis would be identical if there's someone here that was not discharged of the debt, because the debt still exists, the money's still owed, and the debt is still represented by the note.
And so, you say the note was not, or your client's position is that the note was not in possession at the time they issued the began the foreclosure.
That is absolutely correct.
Didn't they recover the note?
Ultimately.
Where was it?
Great question, Your Honor. There is no evidence anywhere in the record as to where the note was. There's, in fact, an 11-year hole in the record where we do not know where the note was.
Okay, but the note was in the possession of the plaintiff here.
A year after the lawsuit was filed, the plaintiff finally obtained possession of the note.
Okay, but do you know that that note wasn't in their possession at the time that they instituted the lawsuit?
Yes, because now when they filed the lawsuit, the allegation was that the trust was the holder of the note. Of
right.
course, the holder status requires possession of the original. But when a year later they had filed a motion for summary judgment, a year later the trial court said, we order you to present the note in court for inspection. At that time, they withdrew their motion for summary judgment, filed an affidavit of loss note that was dated in 2010, and saying, well, we never really had possession of the note. Here's a lost note affidavit executed by Wells Fargo, two people downstream from them.
Right.
So we're gonna proceed now as if we have a lost note. If they come into court and say, we need to proceed under a lost note affidavit that we obtained, they really never really attempted, but from Wells Fargo, that tells me that no, the trust was never in possession of the note until sometime in August 2012 when they came back
Counsel,
to court and said, oh, we
what's
found
the
it.
Remedy? What's the remedy at that point? That's what troubles me on these cases. It looks like everybody was being fairly honest with each other. So when they finally have the note, is it your position, therefore, the underlying action should be dismissed and refiled now that the original note has been found?
Yes. Because at the time the suit was filed, the trust did not have possession of the note, was not entitled under the Uniform Commercial Code.
And where does that leave your client if they can just have a do-over?
Well, Your Honor, in this regard, it's the same situation that we had in Schwarzwald, in that the plaintiff needs to have standing, needs to have an injury at the time it files suit, or the common pleas court's jurisdiction is never invoked.
All right, but now they have the note, and
yes.
And it's very cloudy as to did they have it originally and they couldn't find it, and then all of a sudden they found it, and then they withdrew that affidavit and said, aha, we've got the note. We don't know that.
There is nothing in the record. I agree, there's nothing in the record just to tell us where the note was on the date that suit was
and
filed.
It could have been in their possession. They just didn't know it was in their possession.
I suppose that's theoretically possible, but that, too, is speculation. I mean, there's nothing in the record to show one
that,
way
but
or the
there's
other.
Nothing in the record either way at this point where it was from the time they filed the affidavit for the lost note until they came back, what, a year and a half later, 2 years?
It was almost a year exactly from the date they filed suit that they finally obtained possession of the note. And
Wait a minute. You say they finally obtained possession of the note. They may have had it all along, and because of the volume of their documents, they didn't recognize they had it.
Again,
but that's neither here nor there. I'm not interested in
okay.
that right now. What I want to get at it is ultimately, even if you prevail, they have the note, they have the appropriate assignments, et cetera. They just reinstitute, and your client is foreclosed upon.
They need to refile, Your Honor.
I understand that. They refile, and 6 months later,
that's right.
Your client's out of the house.
Perhaps, assuming that, in fact, they can still prove their case. But we have to keep in mind the nature of the issue we're here to discuss, which is standing, and more specifically, justiciability, which is this court has held several times.
Well, counsel, that's what troubles me about your answers about refiling, because I guess I'm following the chief here. We don't know by this record that they did not possess that note on the date of filing, do we? Possess. They said it was lost.
They said
it was lost in Ohio. Ohio is, I know you're going to be offended by this phrase, but Ohio is a notice pleading state. And when they filed the lawsuit, they said, you owe me $140,000, now pay up.
They alleged that they were the holder of the note, Your Honor.
I fully understand that, but by alleging they're the holder of the note, that in this computer age, in this bank merger age, we can't quite find it today, but we hold it. Prove otherwise.
Well, ultimately, and I'm trying to, I can check when I step back, I believe there may have been a notice of filing of lost note affidavit, when they withdrew their motion for summary judgment on the amended summary judgment, I believe there is a statement that we are now in possession of the note. Now, to me, that indicates that prior to that time, they were not in possession of it. And again, we need to keep in mind that we're
but
here on summary
judgment. But you understand my question. In a notice pleading state, the defendant was never here saying, I never signed a note. I don't owe you money. None of that was ever before the court, was it?
I'm sorry. I'm not sure if I understood the last part of your question.
That was never before the court.
Which was?
Denying that I ever borrowed money from you.
Oh, very much so. It was very much contested as to who was entitled to payment. The money was borrowed from First Union back in 2001. We now have the trust, which is through the mortgage assignment chain, three parties downstream from the original lender. So, you know, defensively, the issue was, you know, you've suffered no injury, you lack standing. Those were specific defenses raised, and those were very much at issue in the trial court. And at no time did the trust come forward with any evidence, say, you know what, we had it all along, we just messed up. That never happened, Your Honor. They came forward and said, well, we actually don't have the note. Here's a lost note affidavit. Subsequently, they withdrew the amended summary judgment based upon that and claimed possession.
You're saying a lost note affidavit would never have sufficed under Schwarzwald?
It's not Schwarzwald where the lost note affidavit fails, Your Honor. It's under Revised Code Section 1303.38, which provides for a mechanism by which someone who has lost a promissory note doesn't lose everything. But it's a narrowly drafted statute. I mean, it has some strict requirements in it that there was never really any good attempt to comply with those requirements. Excuse me. Ultimately,
they didn't really need to. I mean, the year is a rather short time, and they found their note. And so, what did they not do?
Because the only thing that they possessed, that we know for certain that the trust possessed on the date the note was filed, was a lost note affidavit and indemnification agreement executed by Wells Fargo, quote, in favor of Celine Finance. Mm-hmm. Okay, there is nothing in the record to show that any rights under that agreement were transferred to the trust, and even if it was, that would be completely insufficient to support the right to enforce the lost note under the statute. The affidavit itself is deficient because it's executed by Wells Fargo, and under the 1303.38, only the person who lost the note, who was in possession when it was lost, and who was entitled to enforce the note when it was lost, only that person may avail themselves of the statute.
And who was that?
Well, assuming that, in fact, Wells Fargo did have possession when the note was lost, it would be Wells Fargo.
Right.
But there is nothing in the record to indicate who had possession of the note when it was lost, and who was entitled to enforce the note when it was lost. And this is really critical because the note had been endorsed in blank by First Union, the originating creditor. Therefore, anyone in possession of the note would have had the right to enforce it.
Counsel, did the mortgage itself give a right of foreclosure?
No, for several reasons. One is, as I referenced earlier, the debt is represented by the note. And in fact, when suit was filed, the only injury alleged in the complaint was non-payment under the note. And because of that one injury, non-payment under the note, the plaintiff asked for two remedies. One, a declaratory judgment, basically, as to the amount owed under the note. and two, for foreclosure of the mortgage. Now,
but wouldn't that go to proof? I mean, here if we're only looking for standing, and I've got a mortgage that says I have the right to foreclose for non-payment on the note, why doesn't that show my injury at that point? Doesn't mean I can prove it, that I have an injury, but doesn't it show at that point?
No, Your Honor, because ultimately the trust had, if it were basing its standing purely on the assignment of the mortgage, there was nothing in the mortgage that gave the mortgagee the right to recover any money. We have to, in my reply brief, I kind of parsed some of the language in the mortgage and how the mortgage is written. One fact that's something of a twist in this case is that the mortgage was initially granted to a company called Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, or MERS. and this is part of how the secondary market decided to, or the mortgage market decided to kind of save some time and money. There was an intentional splitting of the mortgage away from the debt, the note itself.
But that only clarifies the secured position of that mortgage holder.
It is the way the mortgage is written, and in this case, is the only thing that MERS has was pure legal title. It had no equitable title at all. It had no and it had no substantive rights under
wouldn't
the mortgage.
Wouldn't have title.
Excuse me?
It wouldn't have title. It would have a secured position.
But title to the mortgage itself, not to the real estate, but to the mortgage itself. That would be the most that the trust could have had when suit was filed.
Well, the holder of the note could file an action to collect on the note for the deficiency. But without the mortgage, there'd be no ability of the note holder to foreclose.
Right.
Isn't that right? If you divorce the two, one has the right to foreclose, the other has the right to collect the debt.
And that is a troubling outcome based upon the MERS model.
That where we are here?
To some extent, I believe so, yes. That there is a willful splitting of the note and the mortgage, and there is, you know, decisional law that I quoted cited in my brief that says, well, that renders the mortgage unenforceable.
If that's so, then why isn't Justice French's position well taken that individual holder of a secured position may foreclose?
Because they still have not suffered any damage. They have not suffered any injury. The way the mortgage is written, all of the substantive rights and obligations under the mortgage flow to the lender, not to the mortgagee. It's an odd way of writing a mortgage, but that's the way it's written. So the only right the mortgagee, MERS, the originating mortgagee, had under the mortgage was the right to hold legal title. There is no breach of either the note or the mortgage that would ever disturb that legal title. So anyone claiming under MERS is only going to get that which MERS had, which is bare legal title to the mortgage, and that bare legal title to the mortgage is never injured.
So our conflict is between the 9th that says you must hold both the note and the mortgage, and the 12th district that says it's sufficient if you just simply hold a mortgage.
Correct. I believe the
So critical, what do we write here if we agree with you?
That in order to have standing to enforce a security interest, the holder of the security interest must also be entitled to enforce the underlying debt. Because otherwise, we put the execution...
And we would have to agree that the only one that had the right to enforce is the holder of the note.
Because this is a negotiable instrument, is not necessarily the holder of the note, but a person entitled to enforce the note as defined in 1303.31. That's three people, the holder, a non-holder in possession of the note, or as was raised at some point in this case, a person trying to enforce under the lost note statute.
Thank you.
And the fact that she is not not liable makes no difference in your view?
No, not at all, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Cove.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. I am John Cove, and I represent the trust. The certified question asks, to invoke jurisdiction in a foreclosure action, does the plaintiff need to show at the time of the complaint an interest in both the note and the mortgage, or is it sufficient for the plaintiff to have an interest in at least one of those two things? This is another or case. This court just heard an or case about deers and rights under a statute and whether this word or, what it meant and how it applied to the case. This case is similar. The trust respectfully requests that this court do one of two things. Either dispose of the case as having been improvidently certified as a conflict, or if this court decides to reach the merits of the certified conflict question, affirm the judgment below by adopting any one of three alternative propositions of law. I'll address the dismissal argument first. The conflict cases are actually materially different because in the McFerrin case, the plaintiff asserted both a note claim and a mortgage claim. In this case, the trust has only asserted a mortgage claim. There is no note claim because nobody's entitled to enforce the note against Ms. Lewis. Because nobody can enforce the note against Ms. Lewis because of her bankruptcy discharge, the court should not adopt their proposition of law, which says that to enforce the mortgage, you must be able to enforce the note.
The note is not enforceable against anyone due to the bankruptcy.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the bankruptcy, in your view, is essential to this analysis here, where your opposing counsel has said it's irrelevant.
No, it is most definitely relevant, Your Honor. It's what distinguishes this case from the McFerrin case.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. Doesn't this take it out of the 12th District case?
Yes.
So maybe along the lines of Justice French here, are we comparing apples and oranges, and we really shouldn't be regarding this as a conflict?
I agree. We should not be regarding this as a conflict. They're apples and oranges, and here's why. In McFerrin, the 9th District Court of Appeals had to sit and look an assignment of mortgage and ask, does this interest in a mortgage support standing for a case that involves a note claim? The 9th District decided, that's not enough. I want to see both an interest in the mortgage and the note if you've got a case with a note claim. In contrast, the 12th District in this case didn't face that legal question. The legal question in this case is, we have an assignment of mortgage. Is that enough of an interest to assert a claim on a mortgage? And the 12th District, I submit, correctly decided that, of course, the person that's the mortgagee, of course that person can come to court in Ohio and have the courthouse order.
So, counsel, what you're saying is all this talk about the lost note and the affidavits and all that is irrelevant in this case, since the note is unenforceable against this property owner.
That's correct, Your Honor. The only thing sought to be enforced in this case is the mortgage interest in the property. We're not trying to seek a money judgment on the note.
And how, at the time you pled it, clearly the trust held the mortgage or an assignment of it. Is that correct?
That's correct, and it's undisputed.
And there's enough information there to how do you calculate what's owed?
Well, the calculation is determined by looking at, in this case, the loan servicer's records to say how much principal, unpaid interest.
You can't look at the mortgage and know, can you?
No. You actually have to look at both documents. You have to look at the note to find out unpaid principal, unpaid interest. And you have to look at the mortgage to find out advances for real estate taxes. Those aren't obligations under a note. I have to look at advances for property preservation. Those aren't obligations under a note.
But to conclude, let's assume that this property is worth three times what the mortgage face value, because there would be some number on the mortgage to begin with, wouldn't there?
Right. When the loan was taken out, there is a principal amount secured by the mortgage.
But the details of the rate of interest and all of that would probably not be in the mortgage. Is that correct?
They actually are stated in the mortgage. The mortgage refers explicitly to the note, and the note refers explicitly to the mortgage. The mortgage defines the note, in this case, on page 2 of the mortgage.
So it's got all the details you need to calculate what would be owed to the trust when the dust settles.
Yes.
Not necessarily with just having the mortgage. You said you have to have the lending institution's records to show what has been paid, what's been advanced, and what's the bottom line at this point. There may have been a significant reduction from the dollar amount that's in the mortgage to begin with.
That's correct.
So you need something in addition to the mortgage, and really the note's not going to tell you that.
No. And Your Honor's getting to the heart of this, which is the amount that's secured by a mortgage is a question of fact.
Right.
And that fact question is informed by facts like how much was paid over the course of the loan, what, you know, how much interest has accrued. And so you don't need to have a claim on the note to figure out those facts in order to enforce the mortgage obligation. So this case is materially different from the McFerrin case, and for that reason should be this case should be disposed of by stating that the certified conflict question was improvidently certified.
However, if we choose not to take that path of least resistance, what will this case stand for at the end of the day, that a bank can file an action based upon a mortgage only?
Yes, it would stand for a rather unremarkable proposition that the mortgagee...
Well, there are people in Ohio that may find that a little more remarkable than you do.
Well, I agree, and my friend disagrees with me as well. But the heart of this case comes down to, when someone has given mortgage rights to another individual, can that other individual open the courthouse doors and ask a trial judge in Ohio, "I would like you to see if I can foreclose this mortgage, Your Honor."
And you'd certainly be able to foreclose it for advances on taxes that hadn't been reimbursed, couldn't you?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And whatever other advances there might be on payment of liens, for example.
I agree.
So there's rights of a mortgage holder to enforce a foreclosure independent from payment of the note.
That's correct. And in fact, you could have a situation where there hasn't been a default.
We don't want to recognize some new field of law and eliminate that right, do we?
No. And this court doesn't need to recognize a new proposition of law. The trust only asks, with respect to the trust's first proposition of law, that this court continue with its statement that it made in Schwarzwald, which is, if you have an interest in either the note or the mortgage, that's enough to start the door, open the courthouse doors and start the case. You might not win because standing isn't coterminous with winning.
So you're
but
back
you
to
can
my
get note, into court.
You're back to my earlier observation of notice pleadings in Ohio. You're saying a mortgage gets you into the courthouse and ultimately you may run into a brick wall saying, sorry, you're not getting any money on that note.
Correct, Your Honor.
Is Schwarzwald still being misconstrued in your view?
Within the Ninth District, certainly, Your Honor. The other district courts of appeals that have considered this issue have all adopted and endorsed
it
the...
It occurs to me that it's simply a proposition that says unless you can maintain that you have been injured, you can't file a lawsuit. That's really all Schwarzwald says, isn't it?
Yeah, Schwarzwald, the heart of it is to invoke jurisdiction. You have to show that you've got an interest in the subject matter of the case. And in Schwarzwald, which was a strange case, you had a plaintiff that admitted, I have no interest. And so this court was stuck. It had to dismiss the case because they admitted they had zero interest in either the note or the mortgage. In this case, my client has an interest in the mortgage, and with it carries an equitable interest in the note debt and a chosen action in the note debt. If this court examines its prior precedent, it will see the Kernahan cases, which advise and teach us that if you have one interest, the law necessarily recognizes you have an interest in the other. For the mortgage.
Mr. Engel argues to us that there was a lost note affidavit submitted in the case that suggests that we now have an interest in the note. And he assumes from the use of the word now that formerly we did not, but we do at the moment, and he'd suggest the way to resolve this is to go back and start from the beginning. But what's your response to that position that was advanced in his presentation?
When the lost note affidavit was submitted in July of 2012, that was just a statement that at that time they were unable to find the note. The record reflects that the judge had issued an order earlier saying, the parties came in and told me that they're going to bring this note in to show Miss Lewis the note. So when you do that, please bring it to court. So foreclosure counsel went back to try and get the note. And at that time, they said it can't be found at that time. Because they couldn't find it at that time, foreclosure counsel decided to submit an amended motion for summary judgment that included this lost note affidavit that had been created years earlier. The submission of the lost note affidavit isn't proof that the trust didn't have possession of the note as of the date of the complaint. In fact, the record really reflects that, if anything, the note was in the possession of Wells Fargo at the time of the complaint, and Wells Fargo was an agent acting and holding it for the benefit of the trust. The lost note affidavit includes attached to it a copy of the note that has an allonge on it. The allonge is signed by Wells Fargo. Because of the existence of that allonge, we know that at one point, before December 7, 2010, when the lost note affidavit was created, Wells Fargo physically possessed that document because they created an allonge and stuck it onto the document. So we know that as of December 7, 2010, Wells Fargo had the note. Well, they had lost it on that date, but they had it before.
If we would agree with your view on this, Mr. Koff, what would you have us write in this case?
What I would have this court write, if it's going to reach the merits, is adopt the either-or proposition of law, our first proposition of law.
Mortgage or the note.
If you have an interest in one, you necessarily have an interest in the other. That's the teaching of Kernahan. If you have the mortgage, you have legal title to the mortgage, and you have an equitable interest and chosen action in the note.
Is it important for us to write that, or is it better, in your view, to improvidently allow this case?
The trust would be happy with either result.
Oh, I'm sure of that.
For those of us
what we're trying to do is get your view on what is the best path forward.
I think
we'd like your view, and obviously we would like Mr. Engel's view, so that we can consider that when we resolve what we're doing in all of these cases, because you understand it transcends this case, yeah, for sure.
And next time I'm in the Ninth District Court of Appeals, I would much rather have a decision from this court that says either or is sufficient to invoke jurisdiction to
Is this confused courthouse. Around Ohio and the other districts, to your experience?
No. Most of the other district courts of appeals have all followed the either-or proposition. There are a couple of cases. I think the Sherman case in the first district kind of hints at, you know, maybe that the first district would follow an and proposition. But I think to bring some clarity, if the court wants to reach the merits of the issue, the court just needs to basically restate what it said in Schwarzwald, which is it's enough to have one or the other to start the case. It doesn't mean you're going to win, yeah, but it's enough to get the end of the court.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, I'm concerned, though, that do we need that bright line, even the either-or line? I mean, are there factual situations out there, this one, for example, where you're going to, those lines might be a bit blurred? I don't know if I'm being clear about that. It seems to me that what we're really saying is you have to show standing. That's what you have to show. You have to
right.
show that you have an injury. And we're not going to dictate how you do that. It might be in a mortgage. It might be in a note. Or it might be in something else.
I agree.
Okay.
It can be in something else. In this case, it's embodied in an assignment document. An assignment from Wells Fargo to Celine of the mortgage interest and Wells Fargo's interest in the note.
So you would rather, you don't want us to be limited necessarily to a mortgage or a note?
No. I think just to get over the standing hurdle, you just have to show something to show that you have an interest in the outcome of the case.
And that's what we've already said in Kuchka.
Correct.
So in a sense, we've already made that statement in a previous case. And with that in mind, if we were to IA this case, there would be no problem from your perspective.
I would agree, Your Honor. Kuchta has a slight nuance in that Kuchta really teaches us that you can't raise these standing issues outside of a direct appeal. Mm-hmm. But I think the court in its past decisions has been clear that you should be able to get in the courthouse doors by demonstrating an interest in one thing or the other. Again, you might not win on the merits, but this court should continue to follow the precedent that's already been set and decide that if you can show the interest in one or the other, that gets you in the door.
Thank you. Counsel, you may take a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I've got two quick points with first respect to Justice French's inquiry about the nature of the case. The complaint sought judgment on the note. It did not seek personal liability, but it did seek judgment on the note. And in fact, the judgment entry granted judgment on the note. The note is very much in play here. And the fact that my client has no personal liability on it, I do not believe changes the analysis. The one area where my friend's analysis goes astray, and that analysis being that it's enough to show an interest in either the note or mortgage, is that interest is not the touchstone of standing. It is injury. Now, in Schwarzwald, the court didn't really have to get past the interest issue because I think it was implied in the decision that, well, you obviously can't have injury if you don't have anything, if you don't have an interest in the subject of the case. So first we're going to look at whether there was an interest, and as my friend noted, Freddie Mac had to concede that it had no interest in either the note or the mortgage. And that is the language, and that's the reasoning that the Eighth District in Patterson and some of the other courts has picked up on to conclude that you can establish standing by showing an interest in one or the other, but it's not the interest, it is the injury. And in this case, the injury, the only alleged injury in the complaint is non-payment of the note.
So your interest has to be in the collection of the debt. In other words, which is the flip side of injury, if I can't collect the debt, I'm injured.
Are you entitled to collect the debt?
The right to enforce the collection of the debt is what we're talking about here.
That's correct.
Okay, and then in order to do that, you have to, and that debt is evidenced by the mortgage.
No. The debt is evidenced by the note.
Okay. But opposing counsel says if you've got the assignment chain of the mortgage and the right to collect, in other words, the right to enforce the collection of the debt, that's sufficient.
Absolutely. But they're missing the right to enforce collection of the debt as of the date they filed suit. We have to keep in mind that this is a negotiable instrument. And the General Assembly, in adopting Article 3 of the UCC, has stated who is entitled to enforce a negotiable instrument. And that's found in 1303.31. When we start permitting people other than those defined by the statute to enforce the debt, and as this court said in the Wilborn versus Bank One case, a foreclosure action's a collection action, trying to enforce a debt. Once we start doing that, we disturb that statutory scheme, that framework. We start throwing other people into the mix.
But counsel, I guess you had me all the way until you said no to the chief. The mortgage is evidence of an indebtedness. It clearly is.
Well, Your Honor, that's not what this court said in 1895 in the Kernahan case. The court said clearly that it's the note that is the debt. The court restated this proposition in Edgar versus
Haynes. You're
missing
a word there, though. Evidence of a debt.
It's proof. Evidence of a lien, Your Honor. We have to keep in mind that the mortgage sits there of record. Once the underlying debt is paid, the mortgage dies. It has no life of its own.
And that would be a fine defense once you're in court and saying, well, there's a mortgage that didn't get cleared in the last title sweep. But you're still in court, aren't you?
Yes, we are. But I think it's problematic if the court states that persons other than those identified by the General Assembly in statute are permitted to sue on a note, a negotiable instrument. Because at that point, in addition to disturbing the statutory scheme, you also potentially expose a maker to double liability, because if someone other than the person entitled to enforce is paid, the instrument is not discharged.
So in to follow your logic to its logical conclusion, I could not file a lawsuit saying, I own a mortgage on Blackacre. I can't find the note that says the terms of what they owe me, but they owe me money. Please, court, sort this out for me. You're saying that is not sufficient to establish jurisdiction in a court.
I disagree with that statement, Your Honor, because that individual could then have the right, if it's a negotiable instrument, to enforce it under the provision of 130338. All they have to do is satisfy the statute. But in that case, the individual coming to court had both. They had both the debt, they just couldn't find the piece of paper, and that's exactly why 130338 is in there. Sometimes papers get lost, sometimes they get burned, damaged in floods, etc. But in that, in your scenario, the plaintiff had both interests. The entitlement to the money, which is what the lawsuit was trying to do, it was trying to convert real estate into cash. Who's entitled to the cash? If a single count complaint were brought into a common pleas court saying, I have a mortgage I want to foreclose, and the judge looks at the plaintiff and says, why? Well, because I have a mortgage. It doesn't work. They have to also be entitled to the underlying debt. We don't execute prisoners before we find them guilty of a crime, and this is the same thing.
But that court would have to have jurisdiction to answer your hypothetical.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the court does have the power to determine its jurisdiction.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the matter under advisement, gentlemen, and you will be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess?